holiday celebrations in space, and one veteran astronaut turned author. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. It's the holidays, a time for celebration, food, gifts, and company. Many people travel to see family or friends for the holidays, but what if you spend the holidays in orbit? Retired NASA astronaut and Air Force pilot Terry Virts spent over 7 months in space, mostly living and working on the International Space Station. That includes celebrating Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's from orbit. We'll speak with Terry about how he stayed festive and maintained his holiday spirit in low Earth orbit. Then, Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield famously filmed a music video from orbit, performing David Bowie's Space Oddity on the ISS. Although he's retired from his space career, he picked up another passion, writing. We'll speak with Hadfield about his new journey, writing crime thrillers. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? The first astronauts to celebrate Christmas from space was the crew of Apollo 8. They broadcast live while orbiting the moon, reading passages from the Bible. It wasn't the last holiday celebration in space.
From all of us on board the International Space Station, we'd like to take this opportunity to wish you happy holidays.
Greetings from the International Space Station. We, the members of Expedition 68, would like to wish you and your loved ones a happy Thanksgiving.
Hello, planet Earth. I'm NASA's Kate Rubens, along with my Expedition 64 crewmates aboard the International Space Station. We wanted to take a moment to wish all of you a very happy New Year.
From Chinese New Year to Hanukkah, several holidays have been celebrated on the ISS. During his time as an astronaut, retired NASA astronaut and Air Force pilot Terry Virts spent over 7 months in space, mostly living and working on the International Space Station. And while he was away from Earth, Virts celebrated Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's. And he was also able to celebrate holidays from other countries, too. Here to talk about his experience and how you get into the holiday spirit while you're in orbit is Terry Virts. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Good to be back with you.
Hey, so we've talked about your space flight experience before. One thing we haven't talked about is the time that you were in space happened to coincide with some earthly holidays, right? Can you tell me when you were in space and what holidays you celebrated from orbit?
Yeah, I launched in November. So I actually had Thanksgiving and then my birthday and then Christmas and New Year's Eve and Orthodox Christmas and Easter and opening day for the baseball season. So we had everybody's birthday and New Year's and Christmas. It seems like we had all holidays possible.
Opening day seems like the most important holiday you celebrated up there, right?
That's true. I'm a big baseball guy. That was definitely a big one for me.
Let's talk about how you and your crewmates celebrated those holidays, including Thanksgiving, which I know is an American holiday, but it's the International Space Station, right? Did you share some of those traditions with your international colleagues up there?
Oh yeah, for sure. And the station gets, I forgot how many, I think 8 holidays or 6 or 8 or 10, something like that. There's a certain number of holidays. So, you know, we get Christmas and then there's a Japanese holiday, we'll give them if there's a Russian holiday. So since it's international, we don't just get the American holidays. We get Christmas and July 4th and New Year's, but then a few of the other ones are other countries. So Thanksgiving is obviously a big one for us. So I try to make a Thanksgiving dinner. I have a pretty funny picture of my Thanksgiving dinner. It's got the turkey and mashed potatoes and stuffing. It's like dehydrated stuffing. It's all put together on the Velcro food table.
What was it like for your colleagues up there to share that meal with you?
They love it. I mean, everybody knows, you know, especially the astronauts who travel to America, they all know about Thanksgiving. We kind of shared all the food. There is turkey in the American food supply and there's actually the Russians have good mashed potatoes, kartoffel puree that you try to put together. What you did. And we had Thanksgiving like a day or two after I launched. So I was still kind of getting my sea legs. It was fun. Better here on Earth. It's better with your family. But it's also pretty cool to celebrate a holiday while you're floating.
Did you get as sleepy as you would normally down here on Earth after that turkey?
You know, there's no why. We didn't have the wine, so that wasn't quite as bad. And there's not like as much, so you can't just be a total pig and fill your plate up 2 or 3 times. So I did get a little bit of that food coma, but it was like a minor food coma, not a major one.
Did you set the table much like you would for Thanksgiving down here on Earth?
Yeah, you know, I do speaking for a living. And then one of my space talk I do, I have a picture of my Thanksgiving meal. So it's all like laid out. But all the food packs have little blue Velcro dots. So you can like stick the food pack to the table with this little blue Velcro dot. It's all Velcro there in order.
Down here on Earth, was your family upset that you wouldn't be at the table that particular year?
During my last flight, I had teenagers, so they were probably like, whatever, Dad. I recommend to your listeners, if you're ever going to fly in space for a long time, wait until your kids are teenagers. That's a good time to be gone from Earth.
Did you miss your family? I know you said it had just been a few days since you had gotten up there, but you know,
oh, yeah.
Thanksgiving is a time for family, right?
It is. And Christmas and birthday and, you know, all those holidays. It was, you know, you miss them. You're gone and you're not. I mean, I'd been in the Air Force. I'd flown over Iraq. I'd spent a lot of time on what we call TDY in the military, temporary duty. But leaving the planet is kind of that's a big trip.
Let's talk about the other holidays like Christmas as well. You were up there for Christmas. I know that's also in my family a big food holiday. It's 2 days of eating a lot of food. Were there similar traditions up there in orbit?
So Christmas was a big deal. I helped work on an IMAX film called A Beautiful Planet. It's a great IMAX film. And there's a couple really fun Christmas scenes in there, the crew handing out presents. And some of the guys were very thoughtful, like they thought well in advance. My Italian crewmate, Samantha Cristoforetti, her boyfriend at the time, now husband, was a trainer in the European Space Agency, and he sent us up little Legos. So I have a little astronaut Lego, Terry Burt. It was really cool, and it was really thoughtful. And he had to sign them up like 6 months in advance on the cargo ship. So that was really thoughtful. For me, I was like the night before, I'm like, what do I give everybody? So I was scrounging up beef jerky and chocolates to give out. This IMAX film, I'm so proud of myself. I had this idea for a scene. So the night before, it was Christmas Eve. So I went down to the airlock. I figured if Santa Claus is coming in the space station, he'd have to come in through the airlock. And I got the decorations. And I put these little hats on the spacesuits. They're these two big spacesuits sitting in the airlock, you know, waiting for an astronaut to use them. And we had a little Christmas tree. And so I put up all the Christmas decorations in there, and I got some dehydrated milk and some, you know, freeze-dried cookies, and I wrote Santa on them. So there's a funny video of milk and cookies with big Santa Sharpie on the side floating in the airlock. It was one of my proudest scenes in that IMAX movie.
And did he show up? Did Santa eat the cookies and
they were
and
gone.
Take the dehydrated milk? They were gone.
Next day they were gone. There were some weird noises we heard banging on the outside of the station.
Oh boy. That's going to get some people talking about what happened up there.
It was weird, yeah.
You mentioned that the gift exchange, the Lego Terry Verts, and you were scrounging up whatever you could find to give to your colleagues up there. Was there a lot of that? Do astronauts really put that much forethought into what they're going to gift their colleagues in space?
I think, you know, just like on Earth. I mean, some do and some don't. And if you don't, it's not like you're some unthoughtful bad person. It's that you have about 5 million other things you're trying to think of and that you might have launched in the summertime and you weren't thinking about Christmas yet. And so for me, it was kind of a last minute scramble to figure out what I was going to do. But like I said, Samantha did, a few other folks brought up some presents. And I think also if you've done it before, you know, if it's your first flight, maybe you hadn't thought of it, but if you've been in space for Christmas on another mission, then you are like, oh yeah, maybe I should bring some presents. So it was not part of our training or our briefing. No NASA person. You know, this is on your checklist. You have to get Christmas presents.
Pretty low on the priority before going to space, right? Make sure you've done your Christmas shopping. You mentioned something about how you set the scene for that IMAX film, and you said you decorated the airlock. Are there things that you can use as decorations on the space station? Is there garland and Christmas lights?
There were not lights, but there was like a tree and some little Christmas things and like Christmas hats. So I just basically duct tape them to the and you duct tape and Velcro, you can put stuff everywhere. I had them there. You could probably look. I haven't looked at NASA TV recently, but the guys in space, I'm sure, have decorated something for Christmas.
Terry, your stays, at least one of your stays on the International Space Station was extended stay, months at a time. Does having these kind of earthly traditions like Thanksgiving and Christmas decorations and milk and dehydrated cookies, does that help with the homesickness a bit?
It does. It connects you. And on my last flight, we got stuck. There was a couple of different rockets blew up. And when the Russian one blew up, they delayed our replacement crew. And when they delayed our replacement crew, they delayed our return because they didn't want us to leave until someone else was there. So it ended up being a month, but we didn't know how long it was going to be. So I got a bonus month in space. And our attitude, I was very proud of my crew. We basically said, look, we're in space. We're going to make the most of it. And we got the rest of our lives down on Earth. So I think we had a pretty good attitude about it, but it can be depressing. Like the real hardship is for the families on Earth because they're planning on dad getting back and they're ready to move on with you know, summer, especially I had kids and there was vacations and camps and all that kind of stuff. So the astronauts get all the fun. They get to fly in space and look at the planet, and the families are dealing with the plumbing broken and, you know, all the daily life stuff happens while we're off the planet.
Do you have a connection to them? Are you able to chat with them via phone or email, or did you set time during those holidays to be with your family as best as you could, hundreds of miles above Earth?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Now there's kind of a WhatsApp type of messaging system that you can actually set up video calls sort of easily. Years ago when I was flying, we did a video call, but it was like once per week and it had to be on a special NASA piece of equipment. So we had the weekly video call, the family, my teenagers. How's it going? Fine. How was school this week? Fine. So that was a lot of fun. But there's also a phone system that you can make kind of like FaceTime audio. It's, you know, making a phone call through the internet. So as long as you have the right connection with the right satellite, which is not all the time, but most of the time, you can make a phone call. And it's the best phone anywhere because you can call anybody on Earth for free. Nobody can call you. When you lose signal with the satellite, it cuts off. So there's no long drawn out goodbyes or anything like that. It just click, you're done.
I love it.
Yeah. And we had email. Like I said, now they have a text type of system. To be honest, for me, I was just happy to get away from the internet. It was nice to not be tethered to this thing the way I'm tethered to my phone now.
For New Year's, you are orbiting the Earth at an incredibly fast speed. What did you count down to? What midnight? Because you're passing time zones every few minutes, aren't you?
Every 4 minutes, I think. Yeah. Every 4 minutes you go through a time zone. So our time is GMT, Greenwich time. So basically England time. So that was kind of our New Year's, but everybody's home country, they were calling their friends for their home time New Year's. And I looked out to see if I could see fireworks. But the problem with that is you'd have to be over a big city at midnight, at nighttime. And so that doesn't happen that often, that you're over a city at local midnight. So I never saw any fireworks on Earth, but it was good. New Year's is a big deal in America. It's a really huge deal. That's the biggest holiday for the Russians.
Really?
That's much bigger than Christmas. Yeah. Because they hold the whole communist thing. They weren't really into, you know, religious holidays. So New Year's became their Christmas.
Any bubbles on board?
We had, the best was our docs gave us these Alka-Seltzer fuzzy tablet things. You could make a water ball. If you squirt out water super, super slowly, surface tension holds it together. So you can make a pretty big water ball, and then you could throw these Alka-Seltzer tablets in there, and they made fizzy things. So that was kind of...
That's probably cooler than champagne, huh?
I'm not a champagne fan. Gives me a headache.
Well, maybe this year I will have some Alka-Seltzer and water and think of you in your time in space. Finally, Terry, I'm going to ask this question from my colleague, Joe Burns, who brought this up. He said, much like NORAD tracks Santa on Earth, is there anything the International Space Station does from space? Were you able to see Santa and his sleigh across the globe?
Well, you know, I was looking out, but I think our orbits, the orbital mechanics did not put me over the right part of Earth at the right time. But the one thing I did, like I mentioned, we set up this Santa Claus milk and cookies in the airlock, because that's the only way he could really get in without drilling a hole in the side of the space station. So I set up the milk and cookies, and then we heard some banging around that night, and the next morning they were gone. So that's all I know.
So there you go. All right, so Santa was up there. We've been speaking with Terry Virts. He is a former NASA astronaut and author of The Astronaut's Guide to Leaving the Planet, an illustrated children's book, and How to Astronaut, Everything You Need to Know Before Leaving Earth. Terry, always so much fun to have you on the show.
It was fun. Thanks for having me on.
Still to come, one man's career in space turned into a passion for writing.
Fundamentally for me, it's another whole way to really richly share the amazing experience of flying in space. And yeah, everything that's in these books is credible, but fortunately, those weren't things that happened to me. But I think that tenuous link between amazing possibility and the reality of stuff that actually happens, that's the whole secret sauce of it.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the University of Central Florida, offering their Master of Science in Data Analytics program designed to enhance skills in data analysis and machine learning. The new Artificial Intelligence track offers specialized courses to deepen understanding of AI technologies and their applications. More at ce.ucf.edu/data.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The Apollo Murders is a speculative science fiction thriller penned by veteran Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. The thriller has spurred a follow-up book, television series, and is just one of a handful of writing projects from the mustached space flyer, pilot, and engineer. Hadfield's new book is The Defector, a follow-up to The Apollo Murders. We spoke with Chris back in January. Here's part of that conversation now, where he talks about his new adventures in writing and how his experiences as a space oddity and engineer helped him navigate this new profession in authorship. Well, Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be speaking with you again.
Yeah, and the last time we had you on, your book, The Darkest Dark, was out. Since then, there have been plenty of other books. You've been quite a prolific writer. Tell me a bit about your journey from astronaut to writer.
Well, I'm still very much an astronaut, working with space companies, director of several companies, technology incubator, super busy on the technical side. But it's really great to be able to share the experience through writing as well. Darkest Dark, the one you mentioned, that was a children's book. And, you know, it's easy to write a lousy children's book. It's hard to write a good one. And we worked really hard. And we didn't, it was the fourth children's book I wrote, I think, but the only one we published. And it's done great. And I just love the anecdotal stories from all around the world of the kids that are understanding space flight and how not to be afraid. And so I love the idea of trying to share ideas through writing. And now writing fiction with the Apollo Murders series, and most recently, the book that just came out two or three months ago, The Defector. It's a great, you know, personal challenge to write thriller fiction, but it's also having terrific success. And it's a really fun way to let people in on the nitty gritty of what space flight and being a combat fighter pilot and test pilot is really like.
I have to say, every kid that I know in my life got a copy of The Darkest Dark after I got a copy from you, and they have enjoyed it very much. So thank you for that. But let's talk about, you mentioned that there is a challenge in writing thriller fiction. Had you always had this interest in writing, Chris, or is this something that relatively new for you?
You know, where did your dreams come from when you think about it? A lot of it came from media of some sort, right? You went and saw a movie, or you read a story, or somebody read a story to you, or you watched a video or something. Because in your normal mundane day-to-day life, you know, growing up, going to school, whatever, on the ball team, you don't think about the universe and superheroes and exploring stars and stuff nearly as much. But that comes to you through fiction or through media. And for me, some of those early comic books and then movies and TV shows and science fiction books, they were absolutely critical in giving me the idea that maybe some of this stuff could actually happen in my life, that this sort of thing wasn't just a fantasy, but this is a real life part of what goes on. And so to be able to link those together, I've always found really important as a reader and a consumer. And now at this stage of life, where I've had a lot of those experiences, it's just as much fun to try and be someone who's providing those ideas, whether it's, you know, playing guitar in a space station or making TV series, or now writing nonfiction and thriller fiction. And what I love the most is a really good gripping thriller fiction book, you know, where I'm like sitting somewhere boring, but I'm having this huge adventure in my head because of what's written on the page that nobody around me is having. And I've always loved that type of escapism that a book can give you. And when it's tied to real events and real history and you learn stuff and you feel like you're emerged from some amazing experience when you turn the last page, that's the type of book I wanted to be able to write. And that's the task I gave myself. And it's great to see the huge success that The Apollo Murders has had and now The Defector is having. And it's, you know, it's inspired me to start working on the third book in the series.
I want to talk about those books in a minute. But first, what is your approach to writing? You know, as a writer myself, I approach things you know, my way. With your background as an engineer, how do you bring in some of that to the way that you write? Like, I'm assuming that your plots are like engineering diagrams. You know, is that the way that you approach writing?
When I first went to space, we were going to help build a Russian space station, Mir. And we launched without a flight plan, if you can believe it, because things were changing so rapidly and there were so many unknowns that we had a big skill set, but we did not have a plot yet. Even though we were nothing but a bunch of engineers and scientists. And I think it's sort of like that, in that what you got to do is gather all of the threads of possibility and then do a whole bunch of research so that you've got the capability to put it all together when you have to. But then you've just got to start writing. That's what I've learned. And I'm sure you know the same thing. And when you start writing fiction, you're going to put yourself into corners immediately where now, what would my characters do next? And shoot, now I got to look, I didn't even know they'd do that, but that's obviously what those people would do next. And now I've got to solve all that. And so no, what I have as someone with my background is I have the general arc, and I've got enough loose threads that I'm pretty sure I can weave it all together. I've got the major signposts of history of the period that I'm setting the book in. And then there's an enormous amount of research of digging out stories and digging out details. And then when I start writing, now it's weaving it all together and turning it into something that is factually true, but also, you know, a gripping page turner, if I can make it happen. So that's the process. And I try and write about 1,000 words on my writing days. Do it in the morning, because by the afternoon my brain is full. And I'm a constant back editor. Like I read what I wrote the last couple of days, and then I, you know, I'll probably go change some stuff there, and then I start writing, and I'll write full of blurb, and then I go back and read it and fix some stuff. So it's a very iterative process. But that's how the 5 books have gotten written so far. And that's the process I'm going through on the 6th right now.
Yeah. If it's not broke, don't fix it. Right. It seems to be working quite well. So let's talk about the success with Apollo Murders and the new book, the Defector. Where did this idea come from? I hope it's not something that happened in space to you personally.
What I did when I thought, okay, I'm going to try and write thriller fiction, is I went back and reread what I think is the really good thriller fiction, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, and go back and read Robert Ludlum and Ken Follett and James Bond and John D. MacDonald with the Travis McGee series, and Dick Francis with his whole series, and Jonathan Kellerman and Lee Child. Read all those, you know, but read them like an engineer would read them. How did they choose words? How did they attribute sentences? How long were their paragraphs? How did they reveal the plot? Like, it's a real structural, clinical thing to learn how to do that. And so for me, trying to learn the skill was a really important part of tasking myself with putting it together. And then, of course, everybody needs a good editor. I read Stephen King's book on writing, and it was hugely permission giving, because he included a big blurb of his raw writing, and it was terrible. Like, it was bad sentence structure, poor thought processes, but the raw materials were there. And it just demonstrated how the creative spark and the raw work needs to be done. But then you need a good editor to come in and say, hey, you know, we don't need all these words, and you should trim this. Just like a movie director and a film editor have an absolutely necessary relationship. You need that too. So yeah, I'm learning as I go, try and get more efficient at it. So it's not a matter of not broke, don't fix it. It's a matter of something that's working, keep trying to fine tune it.
So tell us about the new book, The Defector. Give us a quick elevator pitch as to what the synopsis is and the intrigue this book promises to give.
Sure. It's the fall of 1973, a height of the Cold War, the end of the Apollo era, and topically right now, conflict in the Middle East, and a Soviet fighter, the fastest, highest flying fighter ever built, suddenly defects into Israel. And Israel trades it with the United States in order to support what's going on. And it ends up out in the desert in Nevada, where all of the confiscated Soviet fighters were at the time, at a place called Area 51. And not only does the fighter come in there, but the pilot, who's a Soviet test pilot, who's brought out there to help teach the U.S. military what to do with this airplane, But the real crux of the story is the interplay between my protagonist, Kaz Zemeckis, who's also a test pilot and fighter pilot, and what the real purpose of that airplane defecting and what the real point of trying to get to Nevada was. That's the crux of The Defector. And it leads to the big, super heavy action scene at the end of Great Conflict, and hopefully setting the stage for the third book in the series.
Chris, most people will remember you from the time you created a music video from the International Space Station, Space Oddity. It was brilliant. It was wonderful. It was inspiring. So it goes as no surprise that you are getting into TV as well. Tell me a bit about how you're now going from writing books to getting into television.
Well, I've done several series, National Geographic and BBC and things like that. But when Sylvester Stallone and his wife, Jennifer, read The Apollo Murders, they loved it. And I was already working with a production house in the UK called Altitude. But Sly Stallone, he actually called me one day and said he'd pitched my book to Amazon without even asking me. And so now his production house, which he calls Balboa Productions, naturally, and the production house in the UK, they've signed together and they are working now on bringing The Apollo Murders to be a television series. And so writing continuing books in that series makes sense. I'm super excited. I'm now an executive producer. I don't even know what that is, but I'll figure it out. I figured out how to command a space station. We'll figure this out. But it's super exciting. Who'd have thought that this might be possible? But fundamentally for me, it's another whole way to really richly share the amazing experience of flying in space. And yeah, a lot, you know, everything that's in these books is credible. But fortunately, those weren't things that happened to me. But I think that tenuous link between amazing possibility and the reality of stuff that actually happens, that's where the whole crux of these books and the TV series, that's the whole secret sauce of them.
And Chris, in the minute we have left here, I am reminded in this conversation of something you told me when we talked about The Dark is Dark, and it's not to be afraid, to take risks. And it seems like that has what has been your success in this next portion of your career. Is that the message that you want to tell people out there, is to just do, to just try, to go for it?
Well, you've got to take care of business. You've got to honor all your obligations. You need to take care of self, family, friends, you know, all your day-to-day stuff. But there's some freestyle time every day. And life is a daring adventure or nothing. You get one. 30,000 days. What are you going to do with those days? How far are you going to try and push your own capabilities? What, when you look back at the end of the month or the year or the decade, what are you going to be proudest of? What are you going to regret not doing? To me, I think you should constantly be challenging yourself to grow and improve your own skill set and try stuff you've never tried before. My wife is doing her fifth university degree right now. And to me, that's the very essence of a life well lived.
We're speaking with Chris Hadfield, pilot, engineer, astronaut, writer, and now executive producer, whatever that means. Chris, thanks for speaking with us.
Hey, good to talk with you. Be well.
That conversation first aired this January. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage is online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.